Hello.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. Thank you for doing this. You are amazing because you just wing it like I do.
Totally.
Okay, so as I mean, we had to sprint all the way across, the hotel because I mean, it's huge. It's a huge campus, and so that was a delay, so I apologize for that.
No, I was worried about that because today has been like a travel day from hell. I didn't even know
Oh
if I
yeah.
was going to make it. Get here on
Oh.
time.
Oh wow.
So
Well,
I'm eating a bite before this starts.
Oh yeah. We have a good 10 minutes before we go live with the audience, so I think we're in great shape. Great shape. So we have yep, that's our speaker. So actually we're going to have Dr. Sinkel go first and then we're going to have Dr. Is it Brabeck?
Yes, Brayback. Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Do you
How's
have the I mean are
everybody?
you busy. Oh my goodness. Are you at the conference?
I am. Go ahead, Carol.
Yeah. Hi, Maddie. So this is Maddie. She is our director of clinical operations at Progenesis, and she has a background in genetics, so genetic counseling, and she will be helping. So she'll host the webinar next month, and she'll be helping us with audience questions and making sure that she chimes in with, any kind of comments or suggestions that we have from our audiences so the rest of us can focus on our respective roles. So it usually works very well.
Okay,
Yeah, good
great. You guys
afternoon.
are going to have the you have the slides on your end. Is that correct, Sheila?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so, where you see Progenesis Academy, this is Thomas, who will be helping us with all of our IT and just making sure that, from an audience-facing perspective, that the audience is able to see the question and answer session, are able to address each other, because we want this to be a more of an interactive event. So, he's going to help us make sure that that happens. And then we're waiting on Dr. Michael, and as soon as he comes on, then we can take a group photo and just kind of discuss the process of today's webinar. So, Maddie, while we're waiting, we were discussing if you could help us, in addition to the audience questions, if you can, as we have an open discussion towards the end, if you will prioritize the audience questions like normal, and then just chime in, with the audience question. And if there is not a speaker selected that the question is directed to, if you would then just toggle back and forth between our speakers so that way we have an even opportunity for hearing both perspectives. And then right at the end, what we'll do is we will do a couple of things, announce our genes conference, and then also the very last thing is announce our next webinar. So next month's schedule, topic, and time.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Thank you.
Amazing. I prepared a few things to talk about in case discussion needs to be added to.
Excellent.
Wonderful.
Excellent. Yeah,
Now,
yeah.
is
So,
Dr. Smichael talking first and I'm talking second, or what's the order, or do you know?
yes, that's correct. Dr. Smichael will be first. You'll
Perfect.
follow, but then we'll prompt you so you'll know exactly when you're ready to go. Yep.
Perfect. Sheila, is there a, I'm assuming there's a slide that has the quick tidbits of information about the genes conference at the end?
Yes,
Okay.
Thomas has it. Yes, he has it. So we'll have that available. We'll have I'll make sure that it's up, and as soon as it's up, it'll prompt you to go ahead and talk about that.
Excellent. Is that the June 1st weekend in San Diego?
Yes,
This is
yes.
your
Are
first
we going
one,
to
yeah?
see you there?
No, I have a schedule conflict, but it sounds lovely.
Oh, yes, perhaps next year. This is definitely
Yeah.
an annual event. So we hope to definitely see you, if not this year, then next. I cannot believe how fast today is going. I feel like these conferences just gobble up all every last minute of your free time.
They do. Yeah.
Goodness.
At ASRM last year, I think I was on my feet for 14 hours one day, literally.
Oh my
Literally.
God, my
It
shoes.
was
I mean, you have
crazy.
to
I
wear the
swear my knee
heel.
is never going to be the same.
No. Should we? I'm logged in waiting for a host. Is there a different link for speakers? I think that's Dr. Smichael.
I sent you that, and now I'm on.
Oh, okay.
Was wondering the same.
Okay, so maybe we should check in with Dr. Smichael. He's pretty good with emails. Let me see if I have his phone number. I wonder if he's just running behind with patients.
Is Nabil here?
He is not. He's actually, so I submitted an abstract to this conference, which was selected for an oral presentation.
Oh.
Well, rookie mistake. I'm in Texas. That's Central Time. This is Pacific Time. So I'm like, oh yeah, this will be perfect. I'm going to do the webinar at 3 o'clock, then I'm going to go do the oral presentation. Nope, it's all the same time. Everything's at the same time. So in addition to that, I'm an abstract reviewer. So Marlene Engel, she's like, here's your roster, and I need you to do all of these, abstract reviews. And I'm like, all at the same time. So I'm like, okay, obviously I can't do this. So
It
it's been a day. Let me just,
has been a day.
okay, let's see. We cannot start without him. So. I apologize. Give me just 1 second while I check in. All right.
What time zone is he in?
He should be in Pacific also. His clinic is based in California.
Okay.
Right. Can we,
You want to start it? Or just.
well, I mean, I would rather have him so we can
Sure.
wait a few more minutes.
That's fine.
Can you see the attendees? Can you see them joining?
Doesn't want me to see.
You're all good till you got those slides ready.
I mean, I think everything but the speaker. We have everything ready but the speaker.
Well, it's
So,
his is probably more talking about SOPs, and so that it seems like it would lend itself to being the first speaker better, but see.
okay, we'll give him a few more minutes. And if he is not able to join in time, what we might do is we might change it up a little bit and have you go first. Dr. Babak, and then as he's able to join, then we'll have him follow.
Sure. I'm open either whatever you I'm open to whatever
Okay.
people would
Yeah,
like.
sometimes these last minute things happen and there's not really, we can't control it. So unfortunately, it's, you just have to play it by ear sometimes. We'll just give it another couple of minutes and then we'll get going.
Have you had a favorite talk at the conference yet?
You know, I haven't been able to attend a single talk. Do you believe that?
Oh no. I
No, because
do,
I have been
but
like back to back. It's just been unreal, unreal. I've heard very many good things about the talk from Dr. Erica Behnke about updates CapTecla. So, I mean, there's that.
Where is it? Where are you guys?
We are in Vegas right now.
Ah,
Yeah.
I'm in San Diego.
Right.
I would have loved to have seen that one about the cap checklist.
but I'm just couldn't get in or any earlier today.
Do they record your those sessions?
Don't know. I don't know. The AAB is not as technologically savvy as you would think. Was the talk about the exam, what it is and what it isn't from Brooks Keel, was that today? You don't know.
No, I couldn't tell you because I haven't even had a chance to look at the schedule. Not
Yeah.
nothing. It's just been crazy running
So
around.
I run a couple of groups for like exam prep, you know. And the test takers this year said that they really changed up the exam.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And
Interesting.
they said basically like it follows nothing in the manual this year.
Is that surprising to you?
Well, in past years, at least it followed the manual, so it was hard to study for, but it was like, you know, at least it was in the manual, right?
I feel like it could have probably followed the manual a little closer than it has in the past, but
My lights will go
and there's
off if I don't move around, so I'm sure
oh.
that Overland Park code is the lights will shut off if you don't stand up every now and again.
Okay, I'm not really sure what's going on with Dr. Smichael. Does anyone have communication from him? How do you?
No, I'm so sorry.
Okay, all right.
I
Let's
have a
see.
couple of very general slides I can give as an intro if you don't
Dr.
want to pick any
Smichael,
of
I'm
them. Oh,
so,
it looks like
oh,
Hugh just
well.
responded a minute ago, says still can't see the link.
Do you have his link?
Yeah, I sent his link. I resent his link to him again, so he'll be getting another email from Zoom to
Can you
apologize.
copy that link and send it to me in the chat?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry guys, one more
Okay.
second. I'm gonna get hopefully our other speaker on, and then we can finally get started.
I'm literally still manicuring my nails for
We love the multitasking.
I have no idea how much.
I have a poster and I realize that when I show my poster, I like point to it, you know, and everyone's looking at my hands. Just vanity.
Did you send it through like a normal chat? I mean, you're. Oh, I see. I see it.
You
I
want
see.
to feel your best. I totally get it.
And I also have my Rubik's cubes with me. So if you come see my poster, you can get one.
Oh. It looks like that one's already solved.
Yeah, I did that one on the plane. Which made me very motion sick upon landing because the flights coming in here are like ch-joom, ch-joom, ch-joom. It was bad.
Ah, here we go.
Is he logging in?
Yes.
Oh, good, because awesome.
I apologize about the not being able to log in.
No worries, no worries. Welcome. I'm glad that you can join us. It's great to meet you face to face. I know we've talked over email several times, but our entire panel is ready, and I think we're like about 5 minutes over. So we're going to go ahead and just dive in. And also, if we can take a
Just take a screenshot.
Okay, everyone, smile. Okay, perfect. We have a screenshot. Okay, we're going to go live. I'll introduce the webinar, and then we'll introduce our speakers. We're going to go ahead and give both bios together, and then I'll direct you, Dr. Smichel, to go ahead and start your presentation first. And then once you're done, I'll go ahead and direct Dr. Brayback to start her presentation. And when she's done, we're going to go ahead and open up the discussion forum. Okay. Okay, here we go. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us at the Progenesis webinar. We're very excited to have you today, and we have a wonderful panel lined up today for you guys, and our topic is also excellent. So today we'll be discussing the involvement of medical directors in laboratory operations, and we're focused on how effective relationships can be built so that way the laboratory benefits as well as the clinic. We have on our panel today Dr. Colin Smichel, who is the medical director, and he graduated from Yale School of Medicine in 1985 before completing a residency in OBGYN at Birmingham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, from 1985 to 1989. He then completed a fellowship in reproductive endocrinology and infertility at the University of California in San Francisco from 1994 to 1996. Dr. Smichel has one office in California where he specializes in reproductive endocrinology and infertility. We also have on our panel Dr. Celeste Brayback, who is the medical director at the Reproductive Resource Center of Greater Kansas City. Dr. Brayback completed her reproductive health and infertility specialty training at Harvard University and has developed or helped thousands of couples build families. Originally, she's from Omaha, Nebraska. She receives her bachelor's degree with the highest honors from St. Mary's University in San Antonio, Texas, and her medical degree from the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. Dr. Brayback went to complete her residency in OBGYN at Creighton University Medical Center in Omaha and completed her fellowship in reproductive endocrinology and infertility at Harvard in Boston. She was an assistant professor at Creighton University School of Medicine Division of Reproductive Endocrinology in Nebraska, and in September of 1999 joined the Reproductive Resource Center in Greater Kansas City. She became medical director at RRC in January 2010. In addition to our panelists today, we have a special cohort that is joining us as a guest co-host, and that's Dr. Carol Carrillo. And we're very excited to have all of our panelists join us as well as our co-host. So let's go ahead and start our webinar without any further ado. We're going to go ahead and start with Dr. Colin Smichel.
Well, thank you, everyone, and thank you for the opportunity to kind of present at this webinar today. The key thing we're going to try to focus on is some of the role of what a medical director may serve in terms of managing clinical operations in the laboratory. Next slide. Basically, just to say that there are no conflicts or interests, but our goal is to basically provide a supportive and knowledgeable environment to kind of guide patients through their decisions in terms of building their families. And in doing that, next slide. Basically, in talking about the role, what do we do? It's important to realize that, you know, all we're trying to do is to basically manage the clinical team and the laboratory team to make sure they're on the same page, making sure they're working collaboratively and developing protocols, developing guidance and expertise. The overall goal is to maximize the chance of success for the patient and doing it in a multidisciplinary action. Next slide. Specifically, in terms of what we do, is to correlate just in what's happening inside the lab and then manage that in terms of clinical outcomes, specifically with follicle recruitment, stimulation, and timing for triggering. And then, looking at eggs, factors affecting eggs, factors affecting sperm, and then working with the lab to optimize the chances that they're going to end up having success of egg fertilization, embryo development, each with those goals to maximize a chance for creating the best embryo, improving the chances for a pregnancy outcome. That's because that's what we're all measured by. And last slide. Next slide. One of the things that they brought up is basically looking at some of the issues that may come up inside the difference between the lab and the clinical team, and then explaining those between the lab and the patient so the patient has a better understanding in terms of what's going on and managing their expectations. And that means when you're making the lab order to create the for the stimulation, advising the labs in terms of how many eggs they're expected to get, and then managing everything related to consent, managing relations to the nurses to make sure that they're appropriately counseled, and then working with the embryo, the lab, to make sure that the correct number of eggs are fertilized, the correct number of embryos are actually created, so therefore patients are fully aware and understand in the end what they're actually managing and dealing with. And the last slide is talking about another situation where you're looking at managing those same things in a different way. The next slide. And the slide before that, I apologize. That's actually where, you know, basically there's been a breakdown in terms of communication between the IVF lab and the patient in terms of managing information. So there's an appropriate number of eggs retrieved, appropriate number of fertilization, but there's either delays, breakdowns, communication. So patients are waiting, and we all know that the most anxious part of the process is during that last waiting period when patients are going through waiting for information. But making sure we have a lot of processes in place, so therefore you can kind of manage those timelines appropriately so patients are informed, and we are also informed in terms of when those results are going to be expected. So those are easy and timely ways in terms of managing those expectations of patients and working directly with the lab. And the last slide is then talking about managing what we're talking about in terms of those expectations. The process itself in terms of going through is a very emotionally draining and timing one. And each of these pieces that patients got to go through, the thing they criticize and hate most is not having enough information, not having communications appropriately timed. So if we can work as a collaborative effort to have the lab be in concert with the clinical team, and then having information passed along, patients can at least have their expectations managed, because regardless of the outcome in terms of pregnancy, which is always our goal, making sure that patients fully aware and comfortable, whatever the outcome may be, pregnant or not. And that's the most important part of the process. Entailing things to make sure that they're actually well managed in terms of what they expect in terms of the outcome for the program. And I'll end there.
Thank you so much, Dr. Smichel. All right, we're going to go ahead and dive right into Dr. Brabeck's presentation, and then we'll open it up to discussion. Dr. Brabeck.
Fantastic. Good afternoon. And I want to thank Progenesis for the invite. A lot of the work in the IVF lab and lab directors is talking about SOPs, SOP updates, performance outcomes. And I wanted to focus a little bit on really and pivot towards just practical boots on the ground considerations. So the couple topics that I broke it down into: scheduling, staffing, and communication. So thank you. Scheduling, I wanted to talk about first. So as REs or embryologists, we come out and we may join a program already in existence. And so you kind of inherit whatever the program has. And that could be continuous cycles where you're going every week, 365, versus uptimes and downtimes versus batching. So, and as both embryologists, new lab directors, and new medical directors come on board, there's an opportunity to switch this. I've been participating in both centers that have continuous cycles, 365, as well as batching, and there are various reasons why they might fit a particular group. And this, of course, has to be a group decision. The consideration of continuous versus batching cases is extremely important because, of course, the workflow from the entire office is affected, from reception, IVF lab, endocrinology lab, andro lab, clinic patient appointments. Are patient appointments going on at the same time as cases, or are one or the other going on? Allocation of lab staff with requests for embryology staff for PTO, for travel, for meetings. When is CME happening for all of the players on the team? When is preventive maintenance happening? Do you need to be down? When do you need to schedule that? Do you make sure that your case schedule accommodates for that, accommodates for time for QC, for QA? And of course, on the financial side of things, the business office wants to know, hey, do we have steady or do we have variable income coming in so that all the operations are kind of maintained? Things to consider are for those who are up continuously, what about holidays? Is your building open? Is the hospital open? Is there heat and AC on the holidays or on certain weekends? Are alarms activated? In our particular building, there's one set of access keys that goes Monday through Saturday, but on Sunday and other days, there has to be special access because not everyone else in the building is open. And so we need to indicate to the building, hey, we're open 365. We need access at 2 o'clock in the morning. Every year I get an email that says, oh, hey, the medical office building administrative offices will be closed from December 20th to January 6th. Have a great holiday. Does anybody need access? And of course, yes, because we might have to even come in the middle of the night to address embryos in the lab. Next would be number of cases per day, per week, per month, per year. And I think it's very important for the team together to talk about, is there a minimum number of cases you need to have? Are there a maximum number of cases you feel like you do in any one day or week? Do the stimulation protocols that the clinical side do allow us to trigger a day early or to trigger a one day later if that's needed for balancing workflow? And as we know, as REs on the clinical side, some stimulation protocols lend themselves a little bit better or a little bit worse to those considerations. And so that's very important. Next, are there multiple MDs that are ordering triggers and doing the cases, or is there one? If there are multiple REs, are they located in one office? Are they located in multiple satellite offices all over the city? Because as we start triggering patients, in today's time, we do a lot of remote work. We do a lot of triggering electronically, digitally, not in person. When I trained, we were all in a big room having a conference. If you'll go back, please, to scheduling. To the other slide. Scheduling, thank you. But if there are multiple doctors triggering from different locations or even different cities that are feeding into the same IVF lab, how do they coordinate? How do they coordinate which case goes first? Which case goes second? Is one surgeon doing all of the cases in the day, or is the individual doctor doing their own patients? So it's extremely important that there's a coordination plan, because one needs to talk about that, because if one doctor triggers, you know, a high number of patients and another doctor does as well, that could in fact put the caseload higher than would be optimal for the entire workflow. And coordination with anesthesia availability. So anesthesia availability in some cities is not easy to come by. And in medical office buildings, sometimes there's limitations of they're only available certain days or certain times, versus if you're in a hospital setting or you have 24/7 availability, that all has to be coordinated, because of course, some patients will take shorter or longer to stimulate than what is anticipated. Next, I talk on this same, keeping on the same slide, nurse staffing, room turnover, IVF lab staffing. Do you have embryologist redundancy? Because we know things happen. There's illness. There is, we've had on-site embryologists, we've had per diems. And so travel considerations. In the middle of COVID, pilots were not flying, flight attendants weren't going, airports were closing. It doesn't matter what the weather is in your location. If there's a thunderstorm or blizzard somewhere else, or other travel problems, that needs to be taken into consideration. So at our center, when we have per diems, I do request that they not take the last flight of the day before, if we have cases in the morning. They've got to have at least one backup flight. And I need to know that, hey, can you drive here if need be and be here in time? That has to be planned. You cannot assume, because in per diems, as we all know, you might be working the day before somewhere else. You're going to work as late as you can and fly to the next place. And so that's risky. That's a potential liability. We need to be aware of that. Timing of documentation. When is that happening? Is that happening during cases, in between cases, later on in the day? So those are things to kind of build in that schedule as well. Next on this slide, still on scheduling slide, is sperm prep. What type of sperm prep is happening? Are the embryologists doing the sperm prep? Is the andrology lab doing the sperm prep? Are you doing gradient? Are you doing Zymot? What other kind of sperm prep needs to be considered? All of these things impact flow in the lab and it just boots on the ground logistical consideration. Next, still on this scheduling slide is deliveries. It's very disruptive to have your nitrogen tanks or Dewars being refilled in the middle of cases when patients can hear, whether it's a retrieval or a transfer. Or the tank operator is bringing them in. You can hear that. It causes bouncing in the floor and the walls and a lot of noise. And so to schedule that around cases or around transfers, so they're not happening exactly at the same time. Are deliveries of donor egg and donor sperm coming into the lab that's disrupting the detailed focus that that team needs to have in the middle of the case? So in our center, we request that doesn't happen during the case. They will have to wait. It has to be in between. We need to have communication. Scheduling also, at some point in time, the embryologist, this happened to me in the last month or two, needed a little extra time between cases. And so that needs to be communicated to the surgeon, because anesthesia does not want to have the patient asleep any longer than necessary to reduce morbidity and mortality. So it's fine. I'm happy to delay the case. That's absolutely fine. We have to communicate together to say, hey, we're running a little late. We need to do something. And so super important that we have that discussion to optimize outcome. Next on the same slide is case order. And so super important, particularly when there is more than one doctor, but the entire team is involved in this. And you might have different embryologists. You may have the same embryologist every day and every month, but there could be different embryologists that don't operate with the same desires or the same workflow as another team of embryologists. So not to make those assumptions, it needs to be communicated up front. So for example, if you have a bunch of cases one day, are you going low egg number to high number? Are you going vice versa? If you're doing oocyte freezing, are you doing those first? Are you doing those in the middle? Are you doing those last? If you decide there's an oocyte cryo smack dab in the middle of the day because of there's no sperm or there's an extremely high number of eggs, do you have the availabilities to do that and the staffing to do that? So where that needs to come in the lineup of cases. Oocyte warming cases, those are totally different. In our center, we don't schedule the exact day of those until we know when the triggers are, which we love, because why add them to a day? Why commit to a patient months in advance? It's going to be this date. When if I've got retrievals for several days in a row and there's one day that has a low number and one day that has a high number of cases, let's balance out those cases and put those on a day that is a much more comfortable pace for everybody. Testing before the retrieval, are you going to do it the day of the retrieval? Is it going to be done at your office? Is it going to be done at a urologist's office, which requires some travel? How is the communication between the urologists and the embryologists and the MD? All those people need to communicate as far as like, hey, how many pokes is it going to be? When do we feel like we have enough sperm? In our center, typically patients with expected long recovery, that is one of the considerations for case order. And so if I think they're going to be a long recovery, I'm going to put them towards the end because I don't want to take up a pre and post-op bay to allow those cases to run on time for the next case. Then there are patients with medical considerations, such as insulin-dependent diabetes. We need to keep in mind how long a patient is NPO. And so sometimes the way the IVF lab would prefer the case gets altered because the anesthesia team or the medical team says, we want to have this patient first for some kind of medical consideration. And of course that needs to, usually that trumps everything. And our team is very, very gracious about discussing that. We recruit patients, and we see patients from about 3 hours away every single day. So are they traveling from afar? Are they traveling here? And sometimes, so I make note of where they are when I do trigger times. If they're traveling from afar, I may make them not the first case of the day. If they're traveling from afar and they plan to spend the night here, then I may make them earlier so they can drive home that same day. If they travel from afar, our request is that they spend the night before no matter what. Even if the weather's fantastic, they could have there could be a road delay, road construction, or that sort of thing. But the team needs to be all aware of all of these kind of things. Again, as I mentioned, pre and post-op bed limitations, those are issues. And so we have allowed we have adjusted our trigger timing to allow for unexpected delays. If in fact your trigger is so late that you do not have an inch to move, to negotiate, if in fact one of the patients in an entire lineup is late and it's the first or second patient, that is very risky to compromise all the other later patients in the day. And so I think to really be very cognizant of what is your trigger time? Do you have a little leeway built in? Whether, as we kind of talked about. And then lastly, we're human. We are here to help people have families, and we're people too. And people have days that they feel well physically, or they don't feel well physically or emotionally. There's a death in the family. They're breaking up with their partner. There's impending divorce happening. All of these things happen in the course of a day. So I like to really be in tune with our time, with our team. And if I have a day, for example, that I'm feeling not 100%, I will indicate to my team, I'm not feeling 100%. I'm going to be going in and out of the room because I don't feel well. Or you do, or we're, you know, I'm going to need to lean on you a little bit more today because of this thing going on. And that's super important for us to think about that. Building and lab refurbishments. How are you going to schedule that? You need to be thinking ahead. What equipment do I need now? What will I need in 4 months, 1 year, whatever that is? Because when is that going to be building into your IVF lab schedule, which affects per diems, it affects lab schedule, you know, all the embryologist scheduling and patient scheduling. So other thing on scheduling would be, do you do retrievals on only retrievals on a given day and only FETs on a different day, or do you do mixed days? Do you do mixed days of retrievals and transfers? And I've done it either way, but I've done it where I'm doing retrievals, I'm doing transfers in between retrievals, and I've done it where there's only FETs all one day and there's retrievals another day. Super important that you talk with your lab director and the entire team, because are there equipment limitations? Are there equipment limitations on number of incubators you have, and how much incubator space do you have that the team feels comfortable, so that you can figure out how to schedule those in the course of a day? And also equipment redundancy. What if one piece of equipment goes down? That's going to affect the flow. That's going to affect the schedule. Does everybody in the room know where the emergency backup power outlets are? Regardless of the weather, it can be hot and there's rolling brownouts. We've had them in Kansas City. There can be snow or ice or cold that causes power outages. That may delay. You want to make sure that all of that is happening so that, you know, you kind of think about that when you're scheduling. Next slide, please. Staffing. The IVF lab and the doctors we're not nurses, but we do need to be aware of the nurse team. Who's the circulator? Who's the scrub? We participate in timeout so that everybody knows the name, the date of birth, what the cycle plan is. Who's carrying the tube? Is it an embryologist? Is it a circulator? Is it the scrub? Are they putting it in the mic? Are they on the microscope stage? Are they walking lab? Is there a little doors and a window? We all need to know what's happening so that everybody knows that. Room turnover. How much time does that take? What are the cleaning chemicals that on the floor that is going to meet all of the surgical regulations in your state, but also that the IVF lab director is confident will not do damage to embryos because of VOCs or that sort of thing. IVF lab staffing. Our center's been around since 1988, so we have been, you know, we've experienced a lot of things. And so all of us will have brand new staff and we'll have experienced staff. And I think it's very important to have a basic plan with your team. Do all embryologists perform all the steps? In other words, does each embryologist capable of identifying oocytes, stripping, ICSing, embryo culture, biopsy, cryo, or does your team split? Do you say embryologist A only identifies eggs, embryologist B only does ICSI, embryologist C only does biopsy? Super important, because you need to know what that allocation kind of looks like. I think it's very important to balance teams of experienced people with new staff. So for example, this last week we had a new nurse, and I was asked, hey, can she do, this is going to be her very first transfer. So one of the first questions I asked is, who's going to be the embryologist with me? I did not want a brand new nurse and a person I've never done a transfer with doing the same case. So to balance that so that you don't have a whole brand new team. And of course, if there's a new lab staff, we're all new. We all had our first day once upon a time. New staff needs more time. There's no question that's going to take more time. And of course, speed will come later, but accuracy is so, so important, okay? Witnessing, are you witnessing in person? Are you witnessing electronic? You have to make sure there's adequate time for witnessing. As I alluded to before, a little about equipment limitations and equipment redundancy, so, so important. And we talked a little bit about timing of documentation. Staffing, particularly if you have per diem staff, and a lot of us do they know your EMR? If they don't know your EMR, then who's going to be charting in the EMR? Because this is instantaneously. In our center, I don't accept a verbal for how many oocytes there are or how many FERT. It's got to be in writing or it's documented. So who is doing that? How is it doing? Who's teaching how to do that? And I've had most of our embryologists know our EMR, but we've had per diems where I've had to bring another staff member in to document what's going on in the IVF lab. Very, very important. Training of the medical team with the IVF lab team. We've had a center where we had very long standing embryologists for many, many years. And I've had times where there are per diems that I've never worked before. They don't know our flow. So I think it's super important to spend some time. You can't just have them fly in, arrive at midnight, be there to do a case at 7 a.m. I mean, you can, but it is not optimal. So whenever I have a new embryologist I've not worked for, I go through trial run of a retrieval. I go through trial of a transfer. We kind of walk through the whole thing. We have pre-procedure planning. What are they expecting? Where are they going to stand? Where are they going to sit? How are they going to approach the person at the transfer? And after a transfer, anytime I do a very new procedure, whether it be a retrieval or a transfer with any new embryologists, I like what's called a debriefing. And what does that mean? It means I take 5 minutes and ask, how did it go for you? You went too fast. I couldn't keep up with you. And the tubes, we felt like we're going to clot. You're going too slow. Your right shoulder was in my way. I didn't have good visibility of the light. I didn't like the way the bed needed to be higher. You needed to lean a bit. I needed to be a little closer to you. I mean, simple things, physically what that looks like. And we need to be able to grow from each other, not be intimidated that, hey, maybe it could be a little, it was good, but maybe we can get a little better if we adjust things a little bit. So I think super important to do that post-procedure debriefing on the first time or two that you work with another team. Other thing about staffing is, do you have a large team of embryologists or do you have a small team? If you have a large team, you have a lot of luxuries that I don't have. I have a very small team. So my team, if it's not going ideal, we got to push through. And reality is there are times that it's hard. We've had myself or other team members have GI flu. What are you going to do? You're wearing a diaper. You're throwing up in between the cases. You have to talk about these things. I mean, everybody needs to know what's going on. If somebody's running in and out of the room and these things are happening, or again, you don't emotionally feel well. Sometimes you have to push through, but we're human. We need to be able to the degree you feel comfortable, at least saying, hey, patient first, we need to communicate about this. Here's how we're going to approach this as a team. It's going to be our best approach to taking care of the patient today. And lastly on staffing, I wanted to talk a little bit about morale. What we do is I find extremely rewarding, and I think most of us do, and that's why we do what we do. It's hard and it's stressful and there's just a lot on the line, but we're working together and we need to support each other. So I think for REs and clinical staff and lab embryologists, both sides, I think having some fun, not disrupting with conversation that's not about the things that are going on, but affirmation of each other, appreciation of what we all do. It is super important to keep everybody just kind of going along the, a pathway of excellence in care and also just kind of have a little bit of fun. Next slide, please. Next is cycle plan. Cycle plans being, hey, what is the STEM protocol? Are you doing ICSI? Are you doing NSEM? Are we doing PGT? Are we doing PGTM, PGTSR? If we're doing SRM, we might have to send extra embryos because the PGT lab may need extra material. Where can the lab see what the orders are from the physician? Ours are in writing. Do you use the STAR boarding pass? Do you have another place where everybody is very clear in writing what the cycle plan is? Is there room for last minute changes? And often there are almost always last minute changes because almost always, as we know, we have to expect the unexpected. I would tell my patient, there's going to be something that's going to happen that's not going to be what you like and not going to be what I like. We need to be ready to address that and what's going to happen. So room for last minute changes. Let's say, for example, you got a really large number of oocytes. Are you going to freeze some? Are you going to ICSI all of them? Are you going to discard them? That could be something that's a last minute you decided. All of a sudden the patient decided, I didn't want PGT, now I do. I want to disclose sex, now I don't. They're just the last minute things that sometimes happens. Again, cycle plans, what if the patient arrives late, as I talked about, is there a plan? What if the partner cannot collect? What's the backup plan? I believe in redundancy, and I usually have a plan A, B, and C on every single case that I do. So if plan is collect in the office, then somebody has to make an appointment for the office, allocate enough time for that collection to happen in the office. Are they collecting at home? What's the communication between about how much time is allowed, right? I mean, before the specimen gets from home to the office. If the patient, if the partner cannot collect, and this rarely happens. We all think that, wow, the woman's taking all these shots and she's having anesthesia and she's in a lot of pain from the oocyte retrieval. And all the guy's got to do is got to go in the room and make a smile and whatever it is, and he comes out. In a way, that's true. But I've also seen this day can be extremely stressful for the male partner because they've been watching their female partner. And if they have been watching, have any degree of empathy whatsoever, many will feel that they've never had ED ever before. Every now and then somebody freezes. They cannot do it. And you can't just say, come back in 6 or 8 hours or don't worry about it. So, you know, do you want to talk about, should we offer backup partner cryosperm in case that happens? Or he's sick, or he has COVID, or he gets called out of town for a last minute business meeting, right? These things all happen. So what's the, do you have backup donor sperm or backup partner sperm, excuse me, cryo on site? Is there backup donor sperm? Is there only one vial or more than one vial? I had a situation where this woman was doing donor egg and donor sperm. She ordered one vial, the donor sperm. There was no live sperm in that specimen. We got nothing. I always recommend more than one. I don't say how many. I recommend more than one. We'll absolutely accept one and only one, but they need to understand if it doesn't thaw, it's not like we have doers full of donor sperm. They're going to just randomly pick another one and we're going to be no problem. So to kind of think about that. Again, if there's not sperm, are you going to freeze eggs? When? Are you going to discard oocytes? So sometimes the plan says, hey, partner sperm, plan A is partner sperm fresh, plan B, partner sperm cryo, plan C. Are you going to, again, you have to choose one of these other things. And I've even done TESI as an add-on, not plan TESI because of ED. So all of these things are possible, but they're going to cause disruption to the team that we must communicate about. Okay. What if there are no oocytes recovered? When is the IVF lab communicating that to the surgeon? Are you stopped? Are you going again tomorrow? Are you, what if there's no oocytes? When are we told that? What if there are no mature oocytes? When do you know that? Do we communicate that to the patient on that same day? Do we wait till the next day? If there's failed fertilization, if there's embryonic arrest, who communicates that? When? I, for one, I'm an advocate of patient awareness. And so the minute I hear something that's not where I want it to be, I'm going to call the patient myself and I'm going to let them know. I'm going to let her know, here's what's going on. I don't want to have 24 hours go on where she's thinking everything's fantastic and there's no mature eggs, right? You're going to go to day 5 and you realize that day 2 there's failed fert. I mean, that's just not ideal in my world. And I communicate directly with patients when things go badly. I don't put it on my team. That's just my philosophy, but you just need to have a process so that it's the last call you want to make is the bad one. Cause that's the one that totally stresses you out. And you know how much these patients are just sad and on the line and we're feeling it, but that's the first call I'll make. Gail knows this, but it's the first call I'll make. Tell me if there's something going on. I need to know. And so those things usually come from us. Who's doing FERT reports? Who's doing cryo reports? Who's doing biopsy reports? Are they a portal? Are they a phone call? Are they both? Are they a snail mail? So that's super important that we all know all of those sort of things. Next slide. Next slide, please. And this is my last slide. So communication. What are the criteria for biopsy in your center? Are they rigid? What if an embryo is not suitable for biopsy? What's the plan? Can the cycle plan be changed? Does your SOP and your entire team allow or don't disallow, can you cry without biopsy if they say the TE doesn't have very many cells? Or is this all in writing and there's no opportunity for changing? Again, what if you have a high oocyte number and you decide you want to freeze some instead of making large number of embryos? What if you're doing a thaw and the embryo doesn't survive? Are you automatically thawing a second one? Is that already set in your SOP? Or are you calling the patient? Are you ready to go? Or maybe the patient doesn't want to use them. What if there's only 2 embryos and one is a mosaic? Have you considered that? Does the consent read, yes, we're going to use a mosaic. No, we're not going to. Do we automatically do that? What if the first embryo survives and the plan was SCT, but the embryo quality looks extremely poor? So we have in place protocols that say, if the embryo quality is not good, I'm going to hear direct communication to me from the embryologist saying, you know, this survived, but honestly, we don't like it. It's not ideal. And we have to talk as a team. I've got to go into the, sometimes what's right in the IVF lab could be the embryo looks terrible. We may not use it, or we may think we should switch to maybe do a DET because the embryo grading is poor. But the clinical team might know she was born with a unicornic uterus. She's had preterm delivery of a 23-weeker that died. She has insulin-dependent diabetes, severe hypertension, and we cannot afford a twin pregnancy no matter how ugly the embryo is. And so then we cannot necessarily switch to a DET if the embryo quality is poor. So kind of thinking about that, changes from, you know, is there such a thing as a backup fresh transfer? Let's say you plan to cryo everything. There's nothing to freeze. There's nothing to biopsy. Does your center do backup fresh transfers? You probably know, many people have never even heard of such an entity, but it's kind of a crazy thing. But our center has done this at times. And is there medication preparedness? Because you can't just come up with this on day five. And the stimulation protocol, some lend themselves much more than others to possibly some kind of a fresh transfer. Sometimes it's the other way. You change from there's going to be a fresh transfer, and now we need to cryo. The patient got COVID. She got sick. She was in a car wreck, the travel thing, her mother died, or there's worse OHSS than was anticipated, and we switched to a cryo. So how are we communicating this? Because of course, the IVF lab wants to freeze at the ideal time. We prefer not to wait till it's completely hatched. So where is that window? We need to be talking about when that is. And particularly if you're doing a high number of cases in one day, if you only have two or three cases, you're going to have a display of 3 hours or something. But if you have 10 cases in a day, the difference in timing from the first retrieval to the last retrieval might be changing that cryo time and what the stage of development of an embryo is by the time you get to biopsy and freezing. Then what about oocyte and sperm and embryo quality? So the communication between all the team members on any kind of, you know, KPI concerns. So we really want to identify this early as we can, so that if we think, wow, something's going on, this incubator seems to be, I don't know, the group of embryos that was in that one, we're kind of worried about that. Or a case like we had this week, we had a case where the patient had a high number of eggs. The first number of eggs, they were like just degrading at attempt to ICSI. And our lab director, being fantastic, directly sought me out in person and told me this. And I said, okay, we're one third of the way through the oocytes. Do not continue at this time. Let's split this up. And we elected, I said, let's ICSI between all the embryo, between multiple embryologists. So that we take out of the equation, is it the egg? Is it that needle? Is it the embryologist? Is it, so nobody has to feel bad if there's complete, every egg becomes you know, unusable, that we have, but that was not the plan. The plan was certainly not that. And that's not what the team had divided their workflow that day, but we did it and it worked out fantastic. Other things about communication is the lab director and needs to communicate with the medical director. What new equipment do you need? Do you need it today? Okay. Do you need it next month? I can't have you come to a lab director that comes to the medical director and says, I need a new microscope and I need it next month. We have budgets. We've got CapEx. There's tax considerations. Do I need to do it in 2022, 2023? If I did it a different year, that might matter. And then there's, of course, acute needs that need to happen because we have to take care of the patient first and foremost. So short-term and long-term, what equipment needs are you going to have? What's the CapEx schedule? What new things are coming online? Not every new piece of equipment is going to be something your lab wants. Some are flashes in the pan that turn out to be duds and you don't want them. And sometimes you do, but to kind of be looking ahead long-term. So really as a team, you know, it's kind of the concept of a symphony. It requires every single player of every single instrument, so necessary to pull all this thing off. And so really lastly, being preparedness, I think, would be the word for all these things I'm talking about, so that the entire team from the front desk all the way through to every player in the center is kind of aware of all these potential things. And I'd like to end there.
Thank you so much, Dr. Smichel and Dr. Brabeck, for sharing your thoughts with us. It's extremely important that the audience learns from your experiences and certainly has takes away some key points that can improve their internal quality analytics. So at this point, I'd like to open it up for discussion. We were having some chats between the audience and the panelists. And one of the questions that came up were the question on the communication piece. So how often, I mean, I know the real world, you know, real-time situation when as events arise, we can certainly open up the lines of communication between the laboratory, for example, whoever the either embryologist or andrologist is at the time, and then the doctor on record with whatever's going on with the patient. But as far as, you know, the verbal order versus written order, depending on how large the practice is, for example, if there are many REIs under the practice, especially if there's more than one site that does egg retrievals, then it becomes very challenging to accommodate verbal orders because sometimes, you know, a written order may or may not follow. So for that reason, and to avoid any kind of confusion and avoid any, you know, procedures that the patient may not have wanted, many labs do not allow for verbal orders. A written order must be made. So Dr. Smichel, can you comment on how many physicians are on your team and what is your policy of verbal order versus, you know, a written order? And then what, you know, in an ideal situation, what would you say you recommend?
Well, thank you for the question. I think the important thing is to realize that because I've worked on large teams, small teams. In our practice currently, there's another physician and myself who are actually doing things. And I've been doing this for quite a while now. We don't have verbal orders for any procedures. You may have miscommunications where there's an expectation that a lab order was placed and it wasn't. But before any procedure starts, there's going to be a written order that actually goes through. So either someone from the nursing team or somebody from the lab team is going to basically communicate with the physician on record to make sure that an order is placed. Because one of the things we find is just that verbal orders, as you said, if they're not confirmed, you'll end up having procedures either done or not done according to what is ordered. And from a medical legal standpoint, if it's not written, it doesn't exist. And therefore, I'm a firm believer in making sure that we actually practice from that standpoint. So basically in our center from the entire time, we've insisted on verbal orders. I'm sorry, insisted on written orders. Now, you know, as Dr. Bravik said, many times you end up having things occur that necessitates change. And then that's a different situation, because at that point in time, you're gonna end up having basically make a change to an existing order. And then that could actually be then first verbal, but then it has to be corrected in the written order. And that's actually not only what we subscribe to, but that what the CAP requires. And our certification, AAAHC, that's what they require as well. So therefore, that's actually important. And for us, you know, like Dr. Brevik, we actually have an EMR system that everything is written. I have really poor handwriting, so therefore I'm really great in terms of making sure that there's nothing that is actually, you know, not... you can't recognize. So that's another way to kind of ensure that you have that corrective action in place. So that's important.
Yeah, I agree. I think from a safety perspective, that's certainly the way to go, especially as I think my connection is poor. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I apologize. So yes, from a safety perspective, that's very important. But also, you know, Dr. Brabeck mentioned that if there's a new team member or a PRN who's not accustomed to the style of the provider and how the provider orders or makes changes to the orders, perhaps that could be, you know, a scary situation when they interpret the order incorrectly. That's verbal. So that's one thing. Carol, you can chime in anytime. I'm going to ask just one more question and then I'll kind of hand it over to you. But we were talking about in our chats also the dedicated time for meetings of where medical director is present, not only with laboratory director, but addressing the entire staff, because it is so important that, you know, the laboratory director is absolutely key, because, you know, the laboratory director is acting as a shepherd to make sure that everything is, you know, streamlined in the lab and the processes are working smoothly. But many times when you have these meetings with the entire team, you'll notice that the junior members of the team will find an opportunity to speak up and voice, you know, that one event that may have occurred that wasn't necessarily mentioned. And then it'll create, you know, an open and live discussion and an opportunity for everyone to learn from that event and possibly even place you in a very good position where you're now in a, you know, like a where you're being proactive and possibly preventing future events that might could be more complicated. So in your respective labs, do you have that dedicated time where you just carve out maybe once a month or once a quarter where you sit down with the entire lab team, given your role as a medical director? And do you allow for when you notice that the junior members are not speaking, do you take a moment to then give them the floor or, you know, give them an opportunity to speak?
Who are you asking, please?
You can go ahead, Dr. Bareback.
Okay. Real quick follow-up on that. Written orders, absolutely only written, just to follow up. It is the only way. And on patients, I'll say, what you put in that consent is what we're going to do. You cannot tell the front desk. You can't tell me walking down the hallway. You can't send a portal that says, you know, I decided not to do PGT. I decided to, we're going to do what's in writing. And I'll use analogies a lot. So I'll equate it to, you're in the fast food line ordering at McDonald's. If you were to fillet a fish and you got a Big Mac, you're not going to be happy. So if there's a change, then first of all, the existing consent needs to be destroyed. Do not use notified in some manner. So there's not two. And if it's not in writing, then we won't do that. We had an example, it just happened this last week, that at the time of the FET, we had a lot of FETs in one given day. And she said, oh, I wanted a boy. So I pull out the consent. The consent does not say anything about a boy. There's nothing in any discussion. Well, I changed my mind. I want a boy. So it threw a whole kibosh in the whole schedule because, you know, then we're going to have to stop. We got to refreeze. We're going to put it later. So we did so, but the first thing the embryologist did is say, I'm not doing anything until I have a written consent, because patients who change their mind at the last minute change it back. And so I thought, while we're thawing, and then sure as blazes, she's going to change her mind and want to have that other one. So super important. Anyway, back to the matter of meetings. Yeah, I have all per diems, so it's extremely difficult and challenging, but they're fantastic and our team is great. So I do once a month sit with the entire lab team. It takes time. It takes several hours, and we batch. So the very first day that they come to town, we have a meeting. We're fresh. We have some energy. And we kind of recoup. How did everything go last time? You know, did we have a lot of aneuploids? Or there weren't as many, but whatever that is. And I believe in the adage that loud is not necessarily right. Someone can be very verbal. And I really try to make a point in incorporating soft speakers, loud speakers, because again, loud is not always right. And experience is not always right. Because, and I'll coach our team, you know, if you've done this a long, long time, if you're a newbie, you're kind of a little hesitant. And then if you're super experienced, I've had some super experienced, they can be MDs, they can be nurses, nurse practitioners. But if you're riding on your laurels and you think you know everything and there's not something new, you could be operating in things that aren't keeping up. So we have to all kind of balance each other. But I do have everybody speak up. And I do think, like you mentioned, Dr. Lee, that to talk about what went right, what could we do better? I do try to tell the team, if there's something that's gone awry, I need to know right away. I will find out. It's a matter of when, but I'd rather know right when it's happening. And I'm not going to fire you and scold you. It's not an exercise in reprimand and making someone feel embarrassed. These are opportunities. These are opportunities to say, how did this happen? And as many things, having all of these backstops and different safety mechanisms in place, usually if there's a problem, it's more than one mechanism that failed. It's not just one person. Okay, the nurse missed this and the consent happened and the schedule and something. So if you have enough redundancies, it usually doesn't happen. But we'll talk about, hey, what could we do better? How do we improve that? And then we talk about, you know, do we change it? Is this a one-time thing? Does this require a whole SOP change that we want to incorporate every day? And then I meet a second time before they all leave. We're all kind of tired by that time, but anyways, so it's not as energetic as a meeting because we're dragging a little bit, but just say, hey, how did everything went? How did it all wrap up? What's going on? Let's talk about the next time. How many cycles do we have coming? Do we need to have additional staff? Like maybe we need to have extra per diems if it's a heavy, heavy month, or there's a meeting or somebody's going to be gone. But I do think those meetings are important. And I go into the lab every day, not to bother them, but I try to be very available every day for things that are going on, because it's super important to, again, back and forth. And so I think that communication is, you know, not only the beginning or the end or whatever, and as each case goes. So
mm-hmm. I agree. Dr. Kirko, did you have a question to add before I go to my next question?
No, I don't think so. There's been so much fabulous discussion. I can't believe it's been almost an hour already.
Yes.
So Dr. Brebeck is the medical director of the practice that I'm the offsite lab director at. She's one of the best, one of the very good ones who really understands lab operations and what the lab needs to run. It's just so smooth. But there definitely are a number of SOPs on the lab side. I think a lot of times people think, oh, the lab makes the processes, makes the protocols, you know, and it's true for freezing and for, you know, semen analysis or for some of those things. But there definitely are a number of like operational protocols that we need the medical director's involvement with. And I put just a few of them in the chat, but it's just for any of the embryologists who are on the webinar today to think about how much, you know, back and forth there is between you and the medical director about certain SOPs for your lab. So for an example, we recently just had, we were affected by the recall of the Irvine oil. So you want to do a deep dive, a root cause analysis, and then give your medical director a report. What do you think was affected? And have some discussion about how you're going to handle that with your patients or your clientele. And so there's just a number of things like that, like complaint resolution, any FDA reportable events, including device, reagent, or with the donor infectious disease screening. What are the panic values? If you have, you know, certain medical directors might like different panic values. And so that's a really important conversation to have. I like high panic values. So if the eggs are not mature, you know, if it's less than 50% mature, I want to tell the medical director right away. I just prefer higher panic values than lower. And then, you know, shipping, discarding, or using abnormal or mosaic embryos is a good one.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you. I mean, those are all situations that we face every day, and it makes it really challenging. But you know what? That kind of leads into my next question. So let's say there are protocols in the lab, and both of our speakers mentioned what their respective protocols were. So I can go ahead and address this to Dr. Smichael. Can you please share with us how many laboratory team members you have in your staff and how many doctors you have on your team? And then whenever you have a change in protocol, so everyone is accustomed to doing one thing, you know, a procedure or a process one way, and then there was a meeting, everyone agreed to a change, and then there is a change. It's that transition period that's tricky, right? Especially when you have multiple providers, and some providers might still be accustomed to, you know, having it the old way. And then there's a little bit of a challenge to getting them trained to the new procedure. How would you say, what do you do in your capacity as a medical director to support the laboratory and, you know, just address with your medical team members, just to reiterate what was decided and that, you know, to enforce the new SOP? Can you just share with us your experience, maybe given an example, and just your thoughts on how to make that more effective?
That's a great question. What I'm hearing is the question of you know, how do you basically make a change, institute a change, and then basically make sure that that change is actually, you know, commemorated. And I think one consideration is, let's say, I'll start out with the clinical situation where We basically, with reducing the risk of ovarian hyperstimulation, started using Lupron triggers in terms of, triggering for egg maturation. That, I'll admit, since I'm an old person, was a lot of conflict because I prefer ovarian hyperstimulation with lots of eggs versus Lupron trigger and no eggs. And so for me, it was not just a change that, there is a lot of data to support, but we had to have a clinical measure in terms of, okay, this is when we're going to institute the change. These are the steps we're going to take. These are the measures we're going to kind of monitor inside the lab. We had KPIs to say how many mature eggs were expected, how many did we get, and what the progress was, just to make sure that we all felt comfortable with that change. And then we monitored it. So therefore, you monitor it for however many time there is, whether it be 3 months, 6 months, and you go back to basically looking back to say, now that you've made this change, are you seeing any differences? Is there a trend to kind of swing back? Because many times what will end up happening is just that people swing back to whatever they're comfortable with, making sure that basically we're all consistent with that part of it. What we do is also making sure that if there's an instituted change, that there's a way that basically that change is documented. So therefore you actually have to go through a certain number of cases. We document it to make sure that basically we're all following along the same protocols. If someone's not, right now we actually have two physicians, we have three people in the lab and a junior embryologist that we're training, making sure that each person is signed off with each of the procedures that they're doing. So therefore no one's going ahead and doing something that they're not signed off on. So therefore, that's a way to kind of orchestrate it. So therefore, you're not going to end up having someone either go back to something they're comfortable with, but also not doing something they're just not familiar with or not basically, they don't know what to do. That's what we do, because it all comes down to documentation. No one's doing something that they're not allowed to do. And no one's actually doing something going back to the way it was before just because of their own concerns. So that's how we do it in our organizations. And the other thing, in front of meeting, we actually meet at least once a month to review what's done to reinforce what that change actually is going to actually reflect.
Yeah, absolutely.
As a little follow-up to that, if I may, and I agree with all of that, Dr. Schmeichel, fantastic, is when there's an SOP change indicated, one needs to address, when does this change need to happen? Is it immediate? You know, the media is terrible, it's disastrous, total recall, we have to change right now. Or, I think we're going to go to Friesel. I think we're going to go to Lupron triggers. Are we going to do that in 3 months? We're doing it in 30 days. So those are two totally different, totally two different ways to address those. And then, if there's the day, if we plan a change in an SOP, we do give written reminders. Like, okay, I might say it verbally, and then I'll send a follow-up internal messaging that says, okay, here's what we talked about. It's all in writing, so everybody has it in their internal messaging and their emails. And then on the first day of whatever that is, then we also give another, hey, this is the first day we are instituting that change we talked about 30 days ago or whatever.
No, I agree. I think the role of the medical director is certainly very challenging, because not only do they have to have a strong leadership role with the clinical staff, but also equally a strong leadership role with a laboratory staff, and the lab looks to them, to have that additional support, to advocate for the lab, especially because you have that, intimate relationship with the clinical team. So I certainly appreciate, all of the feedback. If I can maybe have, I know we're right up at 1 hour, I'd like to add maybe one additional question, and maybe both of our speakers can take a turn to answer that. We brought up in one of the presentations, the comment about the sperm prep. Now, I'll give you an example. There are so many different ways to prepare sperm in an IVF setting, or even in just like IUI. For depending on if it's a private setting or a corporate setting, SOPs might be more firm versus, a little bit more lax. What would determine, like, for example, like a new device on the market, and I don't necessarily want to name any devices here, so we'll keep the commercial aspect out of it. But if there's a new device on the market for sperm prep, for example, or like a new, a different way to process sperm, like a swim, let's just do a swim up versus the routine centrifugation. There are in private settings, more flexibility when one provider will practice one way because that's their preference, but another provider will practice another way. What are your feelings about standardization in the practice versus allowing your clinical partners the autonomy, because they are MDs, to practice whichever way that they find is best for their patients? Because from a laboratory perspective, it puts the lab, you know, in a position where they'll have to remember, okay, well, how do I process this IUI? Is it for this doctor or this doctor? Does this doctor like, you know, the swim up technique versus the gradient spin? So would you comment on what your preferences are and what your practice is? And would that change if you were in a private setting versus a corporate structure?
I can start and take that initially, because, you know, I'll say that, you know, again, working with different and having physicians join and then lead the practice is something that I've seen quite a bit. I do think one important thing is that when you have differences in terms of how things are actually practiced, the biggest thing that it does, in my opinion, is actually then demoralizes everyone within the practice. And therefore, it's not just the lab personnel or the medical staff who are then questioning whether, you know, what's going on and do you have to practice things in a different way, but I think it undermines the entire extent of the practice. So therefore, I go strongly by data. So therefore, if a provider is gonna say, I wanna do things this way, then we should actually look at the information to say, is there a benefit to doing it that way? You can, for sperm preparation, as you say, we'll do the, you know, and we'll use Zymot as a way to kind of look at things. We'll look at things both our traditional way and with Zymot for a period of time, see if there's a difference, and we'll go with whatever the difference is. Because it takes too much time in terms of doing things to individually. And if one of the lab personnel is not there and doesn't understand, or a new personnel comes on, it's too inconsistent to have all these different variations. So standardization is even more important. And I'm in private practice, and I've been in private practice for more than 20 years. So easier for me.
Dr. Burbeck, did you have any comments?
Yes, I absolutely agree with standardization. It has to be the same way for every patient every time, whether it's on the medical side or it's in the laboratory site. You cannot expect all the different nurses and lab techs to cater to Dr. A and B's ego. And so my philosophy is need to be standardized. You set parameters by which, okay, we're gonna process this differently because X, Y, Z, but we already know what that is ahead of time. And if providers have differences, and God knows we do, because physicians are difficult. So we're fussy, we're difficult, we're non-compromising. What I ask my team is, providers, we're going in a room, we're talking about it. We're going to have one consensus before we leave this room, and that is what we are doing. And we are in agreement. We have a united front. And I don't really like that little thing, but, you know, it's okay for me. And he or she doesn't like this, that, whatever I have. But together we decide this. And there's a reason why we have these. When patients ask for things, hey, I want you to do this instead of that. I want you to use that anesthesia medication and that. They don't realize that. We have SOPs and we have standards for a reason, because they work the best. From our understanding that we have now, we think they work the best. So I do try to have those discussions behind closed doors, whether what stim are you going to use, what are we going to trigger, what the lab for sperm, and then we present that as a team for the standardization so that the lab team, andro and endo and embryology, all follow, here's what it is, instead of catering to different whims, which would be very disruptive.
Excellent. What fabulous discussions. Thank you for your time and your presentations. We learned so much, and I hope that our audience did also. Now we're going to go ahead and place a quick slide up and hand it over to Maddie for some brief announcement.
Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Ali, and thank you to our speakers, and thank you to our attendees as well. We'd like to announce the upcoming Genes Conference that Progenesis is hosting this June, the 1st to the 3rd in the beautiful San Diego. We look forward to your attendance and hope to see you there. Please reach out to us if you have any questions about the conference. We'd be more than happy to get in touch about it. I'd also like to take this time to announce our next webinar, which is occurring on June 7th, the first Wednesday of next month as well at 3 p.m. We're going to be covering PCOS and endometriosis and ART with consideration of how genetics kind of fits into those few topics. So we hope to see you there as well. And thank you again so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you, everyone. Have a great evening.
Take care now. Bye.
Bye.